As we come to the Lord's table this morning for what we call communion or the sacred supper, there are many texts that are often used. Of course, the traditional ones come from the Synoptic Gospel, where Jesus institutes this Passover meal and reinterprets it in light of his atonement. And this, of course, we carry with us all the time. But you know how it is when a church does this as part of a monthly or even a weekly ceremony, ritual, or part of the worship. It becomes perfunctory. And that may be all right to a point, because it is the ordinance that's repeated in our lives, whereas baptism is a singular moment. And so it is that we come to the table and we go through these passes or processes or procedures, and they speak to our hearts and they hearken us back to our roots in the faith. Does us all good. But it can get to be a little bit ordinary. And what has happened in these past few months is that the very difficulty of assembly has made it extraordinary. The fact that we can be in the presence with one another, and those who are able to join us by streaming video or by conference call, still, figuratively speaking, join us in this moment of unity where we celebrate together the loaf and the cup that Jesus reinterpreted from the exile to his deliverance, his redemption for us, his ransom that is paid that we might be atoned. Let's read together from the last book of the Bible, of all places, the Apocalypse of John, the 21st chapter. And as you turn, I'll set the stage for us before we read. Revelation 21, rightly known as the Apocalypse of John. What we read follows immediately after the description of the lake of fire and the post-millennial expulsion of the devil, the beast, and the false prophet. These are representative forces, of course. The satanic and the minions of the satanic, as well as the liars who spout his heresies. I always used to joke when I taught in Latin America about the abyss, the lake of fire, and so forth, and I would write on the board the address of my in-laws in Charlotte, North Carolina. They saw the humor in that too. It was a harmless little funny. But we've always known that these are very scary places and they're not to be taken lightly. And so what follows after that is the great white throne, which is the final judgment, in which the sea give up the dead and the death all come to life, and those from Hades are presented before the great white throne, which is the last place in the world we'd want to be, because it's not a place of thumbs up, but of strictly thumbs down. It is where the book of life is opened and all the deeds are judged, and this is where we rightly need to understand that judgment is condemnation. It's not a matter of discernment anymore, of yes, no, maybe, or black and white or gray, but this is the moment of elimination, of condemnation, of expulsion, and they're all excluded. And this is termed the second death, meaning we all have one death for sure, but Lord help us from the second death, which is condemnation. And now then we come to chapter 21 of the Apocalypse. I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth departed, and the sea was no longer. And the holy city, the new Jerusalem, I saw descending out of heaven from the side of God, having been prepared like a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a great voice from the throne saying, behold, the dwelling of God with the men, the people, the folks, and he will dwell with them. And they will be his people, and he will be God with them, their God. And he will remove every tear from their eyes, and death will be no longer, nor grieving, nor weeping, nor pain any longer, because the first things departed. And then the one seated upon the throne declared, "Behold, I make all things new." And he says, "Write it, because these words are faithful and true." And he said to me, "It has happened. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the first and the last, the beginning and the end. I will give to the one thirsting something from the spring of the water of life freely. The one conquering will inherit these things, and I will be to him God, and he will be to me son, child, offspring. But to the cowardly, the unfaithful, and the abominable, and to the murderers, and the adulterers, and the sorcerers, and the idolaters, and all the ones lying, their part will be in the lake burning with fire and sulfur, which is the second death." And God bless the reading of his word. Well, we see what it means to be in the second death rather clearly, and it's the outsiders, and their categories are unmistakable and indisputable. They are the cowardly, that means the ones who will not stand with the Lord. They're the unfaithful, the ones who do not believe in the Lord. They're the abominable, the ones who offend the Lord. And then the violations of the Decalogue, the murderers, the adulterers, the sorcerers. By the way, that word is pharmacist. No offense, Mary Miracle. But they engage in the dark arts. And then the idolaters and all the ones lying, which are bearing false witness. It'd be easy to focus upon this and speak about how awful they are, but it's real simple that they just simply don't have any part of the kingdom. They are in this lake that's burning with fire and sulfur. That is to say, that describes for us the second death of torment forever. It would have been interesting if we had a bulletin, if a sermon title had been Fire and Brimstone. Because this is the text where that's drawn, that very phrase. And of course, it's never been my style to preach from that because it's very manipulative. It's very manipulative to try to scare people into heaven. I remember being at a youth service in the 1970s. That's how youthful I was back then. And there was this moment of, let's have an invitation. And so everybody who wants to become a Christian, all right, now everybody wants to renew their life. Maybe somebody wants to come forward, rededicate. Okay, everybody who's got a burden on your heart, everybody, now come forward. If there's something you're struggling in your life, come forward. And it kept going on and on. I was just standing there with my arms folded. I will not be manipulated. It really, all my friends, all the everybody went forward. They all signed a little card. I just stood there. You're not going to bully me, threaten me, or scare me into a response that's not authentic. I'd rather hear it truthfully and respond honestly. And it is a scary part, this lake of fire and the great white throne. And it is a reminder, a healthy reminder, that as believers, we're under judgment. And that judgment has been exempted to us, not because we've earned it, not because we're worthy of it, but because of this atonement by Jesus at the cross. His crucifixion and resurrection rescues us from this judgment. It's not applicable to the life of a believer. We're free from this burden. We're free from this fear, but it is real. And it's a healthy word of reminder from whence we have come. And so now we read again these comforting words at the first part of this chapter. Because the chapter 21 will focus on what's new and what's real for the believer and what it's like for us in eternity. And we come to this simple phrase where we begin and we will end, that Jesus declares, I make all things new. I'd like to know how to be made new. I'm looking at increasing deterioration. I realize that I stand before you a specimen of of athletic prowess and of handsome beauty. I realize. But underneath all this, I'm 67 and aging, and it's just getting worse and worse. I'm not what you think I am. I'm just a little old man. This gray hair, I dye it gray, sure. But this is just the condition of life, isn't it? And it's just going downhill. Of course, we look at these little ones and we think, boy, aren't they doing great? They're going up. But we know that just yesterday it was us. Just yesterday. We were young. We were bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. And look at us now. A bunch of us, anyway. Not all of you. Some of you are in between. But you can look one side and see where you've been and look at the other side at us and see where you're going. And there it is. Jesus says, I make all things new. And he gives us a hint of this newness, describing the travails of the past. I'll wipe away every tear. This eternal bliss eliminates all suffering that would justify an outcry or a sorrowful moan, or let alone any pain, which is part and parcel of life itself. Now, I can take a gander here at the geriatric processes, but these actually describe what it's like for all of us at all times to be weeping and sorrowful with pain. Those adjectives are very descriptive of life itself in its fallen state. And we have little pinpricks that remind us of this all the time, that keep us humble, aware of our own mortality. The bottom line is that there is no longer death. There is no more elimination, termination. Death is dead. And we can't say that now. All around us is death and dying. But yet he will remove every reason to mourn over death, wiping our eyes clear that there will be no more sorrow or outcry or pain, for because, quite simply, the first has departed. All these things that are part and parcel of the fallen world are gone. They've been cast aside. They've been expunged and expelled. They've been eliminated and consumed. They're gone. And what's in its place is a new Jerusalem that's descending, adorned, if you will. I love that word adorned. It's literally cosmopolitan. And of course, that sounds so secular. And people think, ooh, that's awful, isn't it? To be cosmopolitan, to be worldly. But it means it's beautiful by whatever cultural standard you measure it. Gorgeous. A bride adorned. Looking good. Looking her best. But now think about the imagery and the message conveyed behind it. This new Jerusalem, which is the precincts of the holy, which is the eternal abode of God, this comes down like a bride adorned. In other words, heaven's not for us, it's for him. Adorned for him, singular. The bride of Christ, adorned for him. And so oftentimes we think of heaven in terms of for us. I find it absolutely hilarious, in a cynical, sarcastic, mean-spirited way, the things people say at death regarding loved ones. Because I know if they've just stopped and think a minute, it's bizarre and inappropriate for a believer. Oh, I know he's looking down on us now. Really? You want him looking down on you right now? How about when you go back there to the little men's room? Yeah, how about all these other graphically vulgar times of your life? You want him looking over your shoulder? Oh, now, do you really think that in heaven they're preoccupied with us? Like they're in a great big Zeppelin of the old time 1930s, floating over the ocean, watching down with their faces smeared against the windows? Oh, yeah, boy, I just really am. What in the world do they think perfection means? What do they think it means to be totally in consciousness in the presence of God at peace and perfected? You think there's an echo of the past, and yet I don't know how to explain it. Somehow or another, we are aware of our deliverance, and yet we're not at all struggling with it or frustrated by it, looking around, seeing who's there and who's not, taking an assistance role. Attendance role. There we go. You know, like, oh, and how did he get in here? How did she make it? You really think that's the way it works? For heaven's sakes. And then one time I was preaching about this New Jerusalem, and it was in my first pastorate, which was in Barron County, that wonderful, Glasgow's the county seat. It's called Barron because the Indians burned off the trees to make it fertile. It's just wonderful, classic Kentucky farmland, south central part of the state, right there by Cave City. And we were in a little town right outside of Cave City where there's a blinking light, a bank, a feed and seed, an old high school that was now a grade school, a general store, a little market, and two Kentucky highways coming across, and there's a Christian church, a Methodist church, and a Baptist church. And we thought we were diverse. We were in the Baptist, of course, back there, but the parsonage was just scenic and beautiful. 40% of the offering plate came from crop, and most of that was tobacco. 40% from cows, and most of that was beef. And the other 20% by hook and crook. It was just an idyllic place for a young man with little children to be breaking into the ministry, so to speak. I preached about heaven. With reference to this, and one of our dear souls saddled up to me and said, "Preacher," and you know how they say it down there, "Preacher, I don't want to live in no city. You know, I'm a country boy. I want to be out in the field." I said, "You kind of missed the point. This New Jerusalem's not a housing project." You know, right out of John 14, don't be troubled. I prepare a place for you, and people think, "Oh, gee, it's my own apartment." I could understand why some old country boy would be squeamish about that. No, don't you see? This New Jerusalem is the abode of God. It's the equivalent of the whole place being a tabernacle. That the entirety of heaven is His domain. And we're there not because we are temporary guests, but because we've been made worthy of His presence. Because He's cleaned us up and put us in His image such that we match the place. We're not gods. He is God. But don't you see that now we've been made ready and right for Him in such a way that we're part of that bride adorned for Him? What a blessing. I can't explain eternity any better than that. And everything I'll try to do from here is anthropomorphic. If you don't know the word, learn it. It means to extend or to impose or to superintend your own images on something else based on your humanity. And that's what we do all the time about heaven. Because there's absolutely no way for you and me to get our mind and our hearts wrapped around eternity. What in the world is that like? We are confined to time and space. It's just beyond us. And if we get really honest about it, it would sound boring. Because everything's perfect. Everything I do in life is based on something that's needed. That's absolutely needed, a friction of imperfection. And how then can I explain to anybody that being made perfect and being made right is entirely the most blessed state possible? To being with God and not being bored, to being made worthy of His presence and always exuberant, where there's no need for rest, no need for weeping, no need for pain or outcries, because we're in the light of the gospel, the light of divinity, the light of God. No. I'll tell you something else that's here that's interesting. This imagery that's used comes right out of the Old Testament. He says, "Behold, the dwelling of God with men." That's one of those times where, you know, a clock can be a dead clock, broken clock is wrong twice a day. You know that saying. This is where the feminists actually are right. This is the, one of those places where the word men means mankind or humanity. It's not gender specific. Bless their hearts. It's, you know, twice a day. That's about it out of a 24-hour day. It's pretty weak percentages. But still, you understand it's not related just to you and me and our culture, our language, our gender, our capabilities, but to all people who are believers and have been accepted. All of them are with God, that He is dwelling with them. Do you hear the echo of the tabernacle in the desert? The dwelling of God, the tent of God, that He has pitched His dwelling with the people. And no longer are they on the outside, but now they're on the inside. No longer are they following a column of smoke or fire, but they're within the precincts of that tabernacle. He will dwell with them. That means they're included. And not only that, but we have words from the New Testament as well that are echoed. This is a paraphrase of the word Emmanuel, exactly, God with us. And He says, God with them. This is heaven. This is what it means to be in the presence of the Lord. He will be their God, but literally, He will be God with them. It's fleshed out for us. We have the completion of that promise of Emmanuel. Well, now, when you and I come to this table, when we celebrate the supper again, perhaps it would do us well to remember the presence of God, that He is with us, and that He has granted us the Pentecostal power of His Spirit such that we are never alone. We don't have to anticipate eagerly and hopefully an occasional visit by an angel in order to be in the presence of the Lord, but rather that the Holy Spirit is always with us through Christ, reminding us of His Word and His way and His will, and that we are beckoned to the Father through the Son and pushed on by the Spirit in such a way that we are in His presence, God with us. And now then, at this moment, Jesus declares, it has happened. It is done. Sometimes the translations say, it is finished. And that's not bad. But it's literally from the verb to be or to come. And it's often used as the same intransitive verb as to be, is, are, so forth. Has no direct object, just simply this is that, so in that kind of grammar. And He says it has happened, or it is, but it's in the perfect tense, meaning it has been this way, it is this way, and it will forever be this way. So we hear it and we say, oh, it's happened, and we go, well, in the future He's referring back, which way is this working? And now it's an eternal word. We need to hear it right like it is, straight out of the Bible. It has happened. It is happening. It will keep on happening. This is the way it is. I am the Alpha and Omega. I am the beginning and the end, which means the first and the last. This is it. There's nothing else. There's no more places to look. There's no more hula hoops or dipsy doodles or gauntlets for us to run. This is it. The question is, how thirsty are we? This is our inheritance, the one conquering, that means the one abiding in the apocalypse, the one persevering will inherit these things. This is the person who conquers, who's thirsting, and this thirst is for what is righteous, what is just, what is holy, and what is eternal. Perhaps now as we come to the table, we might question our own hunger and thirst and motivation. What's driving us? What we really seek? What do we want the most? And the Lord's telling us He'll give freely what will quench our needs above all else. He is God with us. His presence is promised, guaranteed. And He comes to us anew as we partake of the elements, mindful that He makes all things new. All things new. Not just some things, but all things new. The word new does not mean new in time. That would be neo. Neo, like, you know, neo this, neo that. Something that's a revision, a revised version of an earlier form. But new in kind. Brand new. He makes us brand new. Now, I know we always think of ourselves as the vestiges of the past. And that's understandable because we have this mortal life. But did you ever consider the literal nature of these words? That he makes all things new, including you and me. That he makes us new in our very nature. Yeah, you still have a past and this fixed form shell of a mortal life, but yet that's the nature of conversion, to be transformed into his image, to be made right for his presence, such that we're part of the tabernacle, included not just later, but now with the Lord. Such that we have one foot here on earth and another in heaven. Not that we're diminishing or depreciating the value of human life, mind you. But that we have a sense of anticipation for what lies ahead. And we live accordingly, as if it really does matter. Such that, yes, there'll be moments of pain and sorrow and outcry moans, and yet we know that these are temporal, because in the hands of the Lord, all of this is gone. It's gone because he's transformed us and made us new in his image. He's made us right with him. And he gives us a sense of renewal in everything we do. This table today can have a new sense for us. As we read the scripture, we capture new meaning and new interpretation or new insights. Not that the word changes, mind you, just that our understanding grows. And he speaks to us anew every day. Behold, I make all things new. Even though they might seem the same, even though they might seem predictable, that the Lord makes all things new. These words are faithful and true. To God be the glory. Let's pray as we come before his table.